910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Tensions in the Middle East at a new high, as an Israeli military official tells ABC. The IDF is preparing for a significant response to the Iranian missile attack earlier this week. The Middle East is one event that could drastically affect the presidential race, with Election Day 1 month away. ABC News contributor Asma Khalid looks at some others.
A potential wider war in the Middle East could be key in a state like Michigan, which has a large Arab-American population. And then, of course, the impact of Hurricane Helene. We are already seeing how that's being politicized on the campaign trail. Donald Trump making some false claims about President Biden's initial response there.
Today, Vice President Kamala Harris will be in North Carolina to see the recovery efforts from Helene. FEMA says it's distributed $12 million in relief to Buncombe County alone. Former President Trump will be in Butler, Pennsylvania, a rally at the same place where he was injured in an assassination attempt. This is ABC News. The devastation brought by Helene is not just impacting the areas of the South and the people who live there, but also the companies that are based in those areas. That includes the nation's largest supplier of intravenous fluids for hospital and home use.
Though they're conserving IV fluid supplies at Mass General Brigham Hospital in Boston,
people should have a lot of confidence that we are delivering care as normal.
The hospital's Dr. Paul Bittinger.
In some cases where we would have what we called spiked or prepared an IV fluid bag just in case, we're holding back on that so that we don't waste any units that we otherwise may need to use for patient care.
The FDA says it's working with Baxter to get the storm-damaged plant back to production ASAP.
To ABC's Chuck Sievertson, the NFL says there were the fewest concussions this preseason since it began tracking in 2015. League citing rule and equipment changes for the decrease, including the Guardian cap, a cushioned pad worn over the helmet. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Farmers in Wisconsin have always been ahead of the times, and it's no different in the mid-1800s. George Esterly was running a large wheat farm outside of Whitewater, but reaping his crop by hand was back-breaking work. Esterly invented a mechanical harvesting machine and used it in his own fields in 1844. He then won a Chicago Mechanics Gold Medal 4 years later. But was he the first in the country to build a harvesting machine? The answer is coming up. Esterly followed up his win by opening a factory in the Whitewater area, building the harvesting machines and eventually other farm equipment too. By the 1880s, 500 people worked there. So was Esterly the first in the country to build a new mechanical harvesting machine? Yes, this man's early farm invention lives on as a remarkable slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A program that helps cover the cost of replacing polluted wells is popular in Wisconsin, but officials say more permanent changes are needed. Mike Moan reports.
Running your kitchen faucet and suspecting the water is contaminated can be a scary thought. Tom Van Lowe and his wife live in a farming community in Marathon County. Their property is surrounded by cropland. Van Lowe says over time they had a buildup of nitrates in their well, with test results eventually showing excessive levels. County officials helped them apply for aid through the State Well Compensation Grant Program, which funded a reverse osmosis system. That was a lifesaver for the couple.
We knew for years that we were drinking contaminated water, so it gave us a lot of peace of mind.
Venlo says they likely wouldn't have been able to afford the roughly $12,000 cost, and they no longer have to stock up on bottled water. Agencies and assistance groups report waiting lists for these grants, saying eligibility is pretty restrictive. Chase Cummings of the Dunn County Environmental Services Department says that existing eligibility requirements for the well compensation program make it hard for people to clean up their drinking water.
Nitrate concentrations must exceed 40 parts per million. The health standard is 10 parts per million. So you'd have to have a very high nitrate concentration in your private well. And if you were to use the current well comp program eligibility, we would have one individual eligible.
That puts many other property owners in a bind because they don't qualify. Cummings says county governments are being more intentional about careful land use. That includes working with farmers to adopt conservation practices so that lower levels of nitrate find their way to surrounding water sources. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, a little bit breezy, slight chance of a thunderstorm, and a high near 70 degrees. For tonight, showers and storms are likely. We'll see breezy conditions with a low of 44. Sunday, partly sunny, breezy, highs of 55, and Monday, sunny and 62.
Currently, 53 degrees.
Maggie Dawn.
Next, I'll be talking with Bill Carroll, president of Teamsters Local 344, representing 15,000 Wisconsin workers, about their endorsement of the Harris-Walz ticket.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is the second hour of our weekly weekend review of all things court-related, justice-related, rule of law-related, including this major memorandum filed by Jack Smith, recently released by the presiding judge, Tanya Chutkan, into the public domain. And so we get this insight, not only into some more of the specifics, establishing how Donald Trump had the intent, the purpose, the goal of undermining our 2020 election, the things he said, the representations he made, the refusal to follow the guidance given him by his vice president, suggesting that he wait until 2024 and recognize your successes, the vice president encouraging him, the president, Donald Trump at the time, rejecting all that and saying, no, even though I acknowledge that I lost this election, I'm going ahead and I'm going to try to remain in power. That's the core of not only the indictment, the superseding indictment brought by Jack Smith through the grand jury in the District of Columbia, but also now this major memorandum telling us what the trial is going to look like and telling us in great detail how it is that Tanya Chutkan can indeed now preside over a trial that includes all of this information, all of this evidence, without running afoul of what the Supreme Court has said when it comes to immunities, the principal notion there once again being that everything Jack Smith is describing here, none of those official capacity actions, all of them private, all of them personal, all of them intended to promote the personal goal of remaining in power. That not an official capacity act. All of that, again, as a part of our continuing review and our assessment of that case, not scheduled for trial yet. Unlikely that that will happen anytime in this calendar year, certainly. But after Tanya Chutkan receives the defense response to this sometime after the November election, presumably she's got the opportunity then to make some decisions about what the immunities do and do not apply, how they impact the case, and then can schedule this on for trial. Question whether that will be another appeal of her decision on that to an appeals court, to the Supreme Court, all of this going to delay, if that is the case, the ultimate trial in this case, at some point needing to go to trial in the interest of justice, not only on behalf of the people of America with an interest in expedited justice, having cases brought to trial, brought to resolution, but yes, indeed, despite what he says, also an interest of defendants in having their cases adjudicated in a reasonably expeditious way. This has already been pending for a long period of time, need to get to trial, and that's what Jack Smith is advocating for. As always, we appreciate your calls, your inquiries, your questions, and this weekend we have Mark on the phone. Mark, glad to have you with me today as we talk about the prosecution of Donald Trump and other matters related to life and livelihood here in America. Mark, glad to have you with me.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jim. Yeah, and it's interesting how all the details filled in into the outline that I had already speculated was the case, because I knew that once Donald Trump was not participating in the transition after he lost the election in 2020, that there was something was funny in the state of Denmark, so to speak, to coin that old phrase. I'm wondering for all, and I maintain that anybody who serves in public office, like has taken an oath, that their actions in private life and private acts should be in conformity with their oath as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. At least not inconsistent with it, right? At a minimum, that. But they should be fully consistent with it, right? Right?
At a minimum. Yeah. I submitted a letter to the editor on, kind of stating that. But I'm wondering, for all these co-conspirators that are currently redacted, they're just co-conspirator number one, number two, has that information been passed on to district attorneys and state attorneys generals throughout the country? That I'd be interested to know that, if how prominently Ron Johnson was involved in this conspiracy and all the other co-conspirators of that, Scott Fitzgerald, who helped arrange the fake, the room for the fake electors, and all that information should be coming up, because all those guys, in my opinion, have violated their oath of office. And anyone who has not condemned what Donald Trump did in the course of this whole thing to overturn the election, with their failure to condemn those actions, to me, should be disqualifying for any of them serving in any public office ever again. That it is just sad to me that these people, they're putting loyalty to Donald Trump above their loyalty to their fealty to their oath.
And cannot, at a minimum, as you say, Mark, simply say we agree that the 2020 election was not stolen, and that these efforts to try to say otherwise in past years and presumably still to this time are simply meritless. There's nothing there. And we know again that the vice president just this past week refused to acknowledge that basic notion. Question whether or not that disqualifies him as a present public official. He's a United States senator from Ohio, but also the vice presidency in the future. If you're not willing to be honest about something so fundamental, I think your point is, how can we trust you in other things, right, related to foreign policy, domestic issues, economic issues, academic things, environmental things, all kinds of things out there? That's the concern, and that's the reason why I think your point is so well taken. As to the issue about sharing information, we do not know that. That's not a part of the public domain, how it is that specific law enforcement units share information. But do they do that, and can they do that legally? You bet they can. And do they do it all the time? Yes, absolutely. We don't know. We don't know if Jack Smith has produced a lot of the information that he has got for example, our attorney general in the state of Wisconsin, other attorneys general around the state, as you have suggested. He certainly can do that. With respect to Rule 6, he's got to get permission from the federal district court judge to disclose grand jury information. But that information sharing does indeed happen on a regular basis in all kinds of cases. We do not have these stovepipe law enforcement entities in America. States can share with the federal government. The federal government can share with states. State officials can share with local authorities information. Why? Because the overall goal is the same, right? It's to enforce the law. Is to ensure our safety and security. All of that can and should happen. We don't know if it has happened here or could happen down the road. Is there anything that precludes that under appropriate circumstances, under appropriate processes from doing just that? Absolutely not. It's a great thought, Mark. And again, should be the focus of state pursuit as well. We know that in many states, including Georgia and Arizona, other places, and yes, indeed, our attorney general is also charge some of the principal architects, not the fake electors, but some of the principal architects with that fake elector scheme, others around the country, other states also doing that. A lot of information out there to be shared in all directions, state to the federal government to the state. That can and should happen. Mark, appreciate, as always, your comments, your insights here, and your thoughts about what should, in fact, happen when people assume positions of responsibility in America, take that oath of office, as you have described it, and pursue that in the oath and in the office that they then pursue once they are in elected positions. Mark, appreciate your comment and your observations as well. There are other things going on plainly in American courts, and that includes a court in Ohio. Let's talk about exactly what a major Haitian group there in Ohio is seeking to do bringing criminal charges, seeking to bring criminal charges against Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. How does this story evolve and come to our attention? Well, the leader of a nonprofit organization representing the Haitian community has invoked what's called a private citizen right to file charges just this past week against, yes, that's right, former President Donald Trump and running mate Vice President J.D. Vance. Over what? It's over the chaos, the confusion, the disinformation that they have spread having to do with Springfield, Ohio, much in the news these days. Trump first spread these false claims about illegal immigrants during the presidential debate, advanced further by J.D. Vance, the vice presidential candidate, become now regrettably without foundation, a source of a lot of discussion inside our present campaign. The Haitian Bridge Alliance, that's the name of the group, made this move, made this effort after inaction, after a local prosecutor, said their attorney, who's again in representing them, failed to take any action in this case. Charges brought by private citizens in Ohio are very rare, but they're not unheard of, according to Ohio law. Examples, for example, might be a grocery store who charges a customer for a bounce check. That you can do under Ohio law. Typically, it's only an elected official, an elected prosecutor who can bring criminal charges. But state law does give private parties, including this Haitian Bridge Alliance, especially when the local prosecutor fails to do something in the exercise of his or her duties, this Haitian Bridge Alliance seeking a hearing and seeking permission from a judge to pursue criminal charges against Donald Trump and his vice presidential candidate as a part of their response to what Donald Trump and J.D. Vance have said, these false claims about these so-called illegal immigrants in Springfield, Ohio. And again, state law does require that a hearing be held before this affidavit that this group has set forth, describing the damages that they have suffered as a result of what Donald Trump has done, and specifically charging them with disrupting public services, making false alarms, telecommunications harassment, aggravated menacing and complicity, all those kinds of things alleged, proffered by this group as a part of its effort to charge Donald Trump and J.D. Vance criminally in Ohio. The filing asks the Clark County Municipal Court to affirm that there is probable cause, that's a criminal standard, and to issue arrest warrants against Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. That's no small thing. And again, this Haitian Bridge Alliance doing this because of the things that Donald Trump has said in the public domain, including that debate repeated by his vice presidential running mate. Their persistence and relentlessness, even in the face of the governor and the mayor saying that all this is false, that shows intent. That's the lawyer for the Haitian Bridge Alliance speaking. She says it's knowing, it's willful, and it's a flouting of the criminal law. Now, all of this, of course, is refuted by the Trump campaign. They said that Donald Trump, rightfully highlighting the failed immigration system that Vice President Kamala Harris has overseen, bringing thousands of illegal immigrants pouring into communities like Springfield and many others across the country. That from a statement of the Trump-Vance campaign. We know what the facts are, and they're not what the president and the vice president have alleged. And we're going to talk more about those as Amicus, a law review, continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Matt Nair on Air.
Matt Nair on Air.
The vice presidential debate. Mike from Kenosha is on the line.
Isn't it the whole purpose of a debate to be on television for the public benefit? The narrative, questions, fact-checking, it's inconsistent at best.
You're absolutely right, Mike. Mainstream media is bailing massively by trying to both sides everything and sane wash everything.
Matt Nair on Air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Most people out here think that taking care of one another is important. And most people would step up for a neighbor going through a tough time. Most people around here help out friends and family when they need it. But the funny thing is, most of us won't look for help when we need it. Talk to someone if you're struggling with mental health, because most people out here really care. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking now about this attempt by the Haitian Bridge Alliance to respond to the scurrilous and unfounded things that J.D. Vance and Donald Trump have said about the Haitian community in Springfield, Ohio. We know what the truth is. 15,000 to 20,000 Haitian immigrants have arrived in Springfield over the past several years, in many cases being recruited to and maintaining local jobs to support the economy there. Significantly contrary to what Donald Trump has said, contrary to what the vice president candidate has said, they've all been granted temporary protected status to be in the United States legally here, not illegal aliens, not flouting our system. But in the wake of what Donald Trump and J.D. Vance have said, we know as well there have been more than 30 bomb threats there directed at state and local government buildings, schools. Those have prompted some closures, the assignment of additional law enforcement protection, security cameras all over in many different venues. Some of the city's Haitian residents have also said they feared for their own public safety as this vitriol, this anger incited by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance has grown. The mayor, his name is Rob Rue, R-U-E, has received death threats as a result of all of this. If it were anyone else other than Trump and Vance who had done what they've done, wreak havoc in Springfield, this according to the attorney for the Haitian Bridge Alliance, resulting in bomb threats, evacuated and closed government buildings and schools, threats to the mayor and his family, they would have been arrested by now. That according again from the attorney for the Haitian group. They are not above the law. When have we heard that before, right? No one should be above the law, including assigning responsibility and pursuing criminal charges for that responsibility when it is pursued that creates these kinds of threats, these possibilities about violence. The attorney has further said that the Supreme Court's July ruling, July 1, saying that a president is immune from prosecution, has nothing to do with this case, and she is certainly right about that. Why? Donald Trump is right now a private citizen, and he doesn't get some protection by virtue of the fact that he's a former president. Vance, likewise, not acting in his capacity as a senator, but acting in his capacity, his personal private capacity, as a candidate for the vice presidency, spreading these rumors that, again, 15,000 Haitian community members there engaging in illegal conduct, including this craziness, this abject meltdown craziness about people's pets. All of that, again, being the focus of this attempt by a private group when the local prosecutor has failed to do what they maintain she should be doing, failed to do that, a local group seeking permission of the court there to go against Donald Trump and to pursue J.D. Vance on criminal charges for what they have said and done and the mayhem they have caused in that particular city, in that state. We'll continue to follow that case as well as it goes forward, a fascinating intersection between the private sector and the criminal sector as well. I'm going to move now from Ohio to Georgia. Georgia, again, the site of yet another piece of major prosecution going on there. We know well that has basically been suspended. That is the criminal prosecution against Donald Trump and many others identified in that case, not by numbers, but by name, for doing what? To trying to undermine the election results there in Georgia in 2020. We've talked a lot about that particular focus. Right now, that case, for the most part, up on appeal to the appeals court, based upon this challenge to the continued involvement of Fani Willis, who is the DA there in Fulton County. Fulton County DA being challenged once again at the appellate level after the trial court said, no, no, you can continue to serve in the capacity as the prosecutor. You can continue to prosecute this case, even though you had this relationship with a colleague. Nothing about that requires your removal from this case, your accusal as the prosecutor. Plainly bad judgment, the lower court judge said. Plainly an appearance of impropriety, but not a conflict of interest justifying your removal. That's the issue that's now before the Court of Appeals there in Georgia, awaiting a decision from that Court of Appeals before that case can go on. But from Fulton County, from that same county, just this past week, a major ruling that also has an implication for the voting, not just in Georgia, but around the country. Why? Because it relates to abortion. And all of this, of course, derives from the recent ruling a couple of years ago of the Supreme Court in that Dobbs case, finding that there are no longer privacy rights in the Constitution that protect a woman's right to abortion in America, overruling Roe versus Wade, 49 years of history in America, stricken down by Sam Alito and a majority of the Supreme Court a couple of years ago. Well, in the wake of that, of course, legislatures and referendums and votes being taken around the country, including legislative votes, to try to fill that gap, if you will. It says that again, no longer any federal constitutional protection, the right of a woman to have an abortion. And so, in the wake of all of that history, just this past week, a Georgia judge, again, in Fulton County, the Superior Court there, struck down a Georgia law effectively prohibiting abortions beyond 6 weeks of pregnancy. Now, what do we know about this? Major, major news. The ruling is written by Judge Robert McBurney, McBurney. He is, again, from Fulton County. Unlikely to be the final word, probably taken up on appeal because of the expectation that the case will ultimately be decided by the Georgia Supreme Court. But for now, striking down the decision by the legislature way back in 2019 to establish a 6-week abortion ban there in Georgia. Still, the ruling today means that women seeking abortions in Georgia do in fact now have greater access, at least temporarily, to this procedure that became mostly inaccessible in the South, many states, including Georgia, after that Supreme Court case in Dobbs overruled Roe versus Wade. Judge McBurney said a number of very interesting and compelling things. He said that the 6-week abortion ban, which was passed by the legislature in 2019, violated Georgia's constitution. And his ruling, again, effectively returns Georgia, this major state in our elective process in the campaign right now, to a position where it allows the procedure up until about 22 weeks of pregnancy. That was the old law in Georgia. He said this: a review of our higher court's interpretations of liberty demonstrates that liberty in Georgia includes in its meaning, in its protections, and in its bundle of rights, the power of a woman to control her own body, to decide what happens to it and in it, and to reject state interference with her health care choices. That's what Judge McBurney wrote in a 26-page ruling just this past week. That power is not, however, unlimited. When a fetus growing inside a woman reaches viability, he said, when society can assume care and responsibility for that separate life, then and only then may society intervene. Again, that's Judge Burney writing in this major case, reestablishing, again, a 22-week ban on pregnancy as opposed to the 6-week ban that has been the law of the land in Georgia until recently. Now, what made Georgia notable is that the state legislature's approval on that 6-week ban happened actually 3 years before the Dobbs decision. That's what they enacted 2019, 3 years before Dobbs was done, now at least for the moment, overturned by this decision by the lower court. Judge McBurney almost certainly to be appealed to appeals courts there and perhaps to the Georgia Supreme Court as well. But right now in Georgia, again, that right, the old right under the old law restored by Judge Burney. And when we come back, more of this on...
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Tensions in the Middle East at a new high, as an Israeli military official tells ABC. The IDF is preparing for a significant response to the Iranian missile attack earlier this week. The Middle East is one event that could drastically affect the presidential race, with Election Day 1 month away. ABC News contributor Asma Khalid looks at some others.
A potential wider war in the Middle East could be key in a state like Michigan, which has a large Arab American population. And then, of course, the impact of Hurricane Helene. We are already seeing how that's being politicized on the campaign trail. Donald Trump making some false claims about President Biden's initial response there.
Today, Vice President Kamala Harris will be in North Carolina to see the recovery efforts from Helene. FEMA says it's distributed $12 million in relief to Buncombe County alone. Former President Trump will be in Butler, Pennsylvania, a rally at the same place where he was injured in an assassination attempt. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Badgers look to bounce back. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco with sports, filling in for Mike Clemens. The Wisconsin football team is looking to find its winning ways once again as they battle Purdue today. Badgers head coach Luke Fickell said the quarterback spot will be key.
We can all pinpoint, he'll be the first one probably to tell you, the first series he went in there against Alabama was not, you know, what he wanted. But I'd be honest with you, he's continuing to grow. He's going to continue to grow. He's going to give us the opportunity, to be able to move the ball around. He's going to give us the opportunity to play at the pace we want to play at. He's going to give us the opportunity to get into the things we want to get into.
Today's game kicks off at 11 a.m. You can listen to it on WRJN, WRCE, WFHR, and WLAK on the Civic Media Network. Meanwhile, the Green Bay Packers will try to bounce back this week as they take on the L.A. Rams tomorrow. Kickoff is after 3 p.m. The Milwaukee Bucks wrapped up training camp yesterday. They'll take on the Detroit Pistons to open up the preseason tomorrow with a tip time of 7 p.m. Filling in for Mike Clemens, I'm Jimmy Cuska with Civic Media Sports.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, a little bit breezy, slight chance of a thunderstorm, and a high near 70 degrees. For tonight, showers and storms are likely. We'll see breezy conditions with a low of 44. Sunday, partly sunny, breezy, highs of 55. And Monday, sunny and 62.
Right now, it's 55.
Whether you own a local business or a global one, you're always looking for ways to position your operation to create opportunities and move on them faster. With Bank of America, you get access to experts, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter, locally and globally. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Copyright 2024 Bank of America N.A.
Hi, I don't call radio stations very often.
Your calls are the best calls.
And keeping you inspired and informed is part of the Civic Media vision.
Thank you very much for broadcasting the Liz Cheney question and answer. I really appreciated that, hearing her voice, and for you to broadcast it like that was wonderful.
Listen to the Liz Cheney interview now on our website, civicmedia.us. Real news and great conversation.
Find it on your local Civic Media radio station and the app. The Todd Alba Show.
This narrative that the immigrants are coming to get you, that's fiction. Look at criminal charges in your community and look how many of those people who have been there for years, if not decades, and how many of those people are new immigrants. And even a smaller percentage of how many are undocumented immigrants. It's not happening. It would be like going to places and say, well, you know what? I'm running for Congress to stop the zombies.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
Congresswoman Summer Lee.
The American Stability Act doesn't just address the need for raising of the wage. The second thing is that tax reform piece, shifting the burden from the folks who are working class to the not just the 1%, the 0.01% of people who have seen so many benefits in this rigged system, and we have to start to unrig it.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, National Security Leaders for America member Randy Manner joins us at 10:33 to talk about Project 2025. Pam Yonke in hour number 2. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a law review, talking about this very significant decision coming out of a trial court. A trial court judge in Georgia, his name is Robert McBurney, finding that Georgia's law that established a six-week abortion ban is not valid under the Georgia Constitution. That law, known as the Living Infants Fairness and Equality Act, also LIFE Act, that's the acronym. And that law, again, according to the trial court judge, not constitutional, and so strikes it down. Now, shortly after the judge issued that ruling in the case, the state of Georgia indicated that it's going to appeal the case to the appellate court, likely to the Supreme Court itself, going directly to Supreme Court. The spokesman for the attorney general there in Georgia said, "We believe that the act is fully constitutional. We will immediately appeal the lower court's decision." And again, this protracted battle, again, taking place in Georgia, is common throughout the nation. We know as well that it has intersected with the campaign there. We know that there is a woman named Amber Nicole Thurman. She was a Georgia woman who died of sepsis after waiting more than 20 hours for medical care to treat an incomplete medical abortion. And Amber Nicole Thurman and another woman who name is Candy Miller died after delays in medical care tied to state abortion restrictions, according to much of the reporting there and the medical intersection of that reporting, understanding what happened to them. Their deaths occurred in the months after Georgia's law went into effect, now overruled by the trial court. In a conference call after this ruling, abortion providers, advocates hailed the ruling, but also sounded what is inevitably a cautionary note. "Make no mistake, we still have a long way to go." Those were the words of the executive director of something called the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective. She said, "This victory is one necessary step in our fight to champion bodily autonomy." The issue related to privacy rights and the role of the states and the role of all of us in deciding on privacy rights in America continues in this campaign and beyond. And all of this, of course, again, in the wake of the decision by the Supreme Court to find for the first time in half a century that privacy rights do not include, at least federally, constitutionally, a right of a woman or of a woman to have an abortion. Other matters going on in the courts of America just this past week. A major trial court decision coming out of a federal trial court in Memphis. Three former Memphis police officers found guilty just this past week of federal witness tampering charges. That comes out of the fatal beating, of course, of Tyre Nichols. You recall he's that 29-year-old young man who was beaten mercilessly, brutally, horrifically by officers. Those same defendants, however, were also acquitted by the jury in that case of violating his civil rights by causing his death. And that was the major charge being brought by the U.S. Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division, the criminal section there, brought against these Memphis police officers. The jury finding that they were not guilty of the civil rights violation depriving Tyre Nichols of his constitutional right to life, but finding them guilty basically of obstruction of justice, witness tampering charges, and giving the judge, in this case, an opportunity to sentence them, nonetheless, on that charge, to some time in prison. One officer, his name is Demetrius Haley, was convicted on a lesser charge of violating Nichols' civil rights by causing bodily injury. Sort of a complicated verdict there altogether. The three defendants, Haley, another one called Tadarius Bean, and a third one, Justin Smith, and two other former officers who pleaded guilty to their role in this horrific violence, still face some state additional charges, including under the state charges, second degree murder. So again, this is the federal case, the federal disposition of it, at least for now. But there's still a state case going ahead there in Memphis, in Tennessee. The mixed verdict in this federal trial in Memphis comes nearly 2 years after the account of Tyre Nichols' death. We spent a lot of time last week talking about all of that. Sickened, horrified many of us, all of us across the nation. an example of a young black man being subjected to excessive force at the hands of the police. Videos, again, of the 2023, the January 2023 encounter show that Tyree Nichols had fled a traffic stop. The officers pursued him. They viciously punched him, kicked him. They ignored his cries for his mother and his attempts to comply with a barrage of conflicting commands. All that coming out of the evidence during the course of this trial. And the extent of the beating of Tyree Nichols, also a major factor in that trial. Sentencing now of these defendants, now convicted, again, of witness tampering, is expected to occur in January, a number of months from now, with the witness tampering charge carrying a sentence of up to 20 years in prison. The more serious charge could have led to a life sentence, again, under federal law. After the verdicts were read, Tyree Nichols' mother, whose name is Roe Vaughn Wells, and his stepfather, Rodney Wells, said they were pleased that the officers were now in custody and that they were escorted out of the courtroom by U.S. Marshals. She said, "I'm actually in shock right now because I still can't believe that all of them have been convicted." All of that, of course, going again on in Memphis. The state charges, those continue. And, of course, all of this as the campaign for the presidency continues. A lot of this, the focus of what the Department of Justice does. Again, this coming out of the Civil Rights Division, being administered by the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. She is much in the news these days, articulating the policies and practices of the Department of Justice when it comes to initiating these prosecutions through the grand jury, bringing them to trial. And this is, again, another reason not only to be focused upon the courts in America and the justice that is sometimes rendered imperfectly, I would offer here with respect to the Tyree Nichols death and the beating that preceded that, but nonetheless, the importance of government in responding to it, the federal government responding to it, finding in the end, based upon the grand jury determination, that indeed there's a basis to charge people for engaging this kind of horrific conduct and bringing to justice those people who would engage in that conduct, whether police officers or not. Again, a January sentencing, going to see what the federal judge does in that case. And then the state court to follow up on this. The larger issue, of course, is a Department of Justice. Who leads the Department of Justice? That's the Attorney General of the United States of America. Where does that person come from? That person comes, of course, from a presidential appointment confirmed by the United States Senate. And that's the reason why this election is so important, too, because the president basically places in that position the attorney general and, yes, indeed, all of the assistant attorneys general as well, who come forward and do the work under the federal laws, the criminal laws, the civil laws of the Department of Justice, of all of us, of the United States of America, including those prosecutions when they are founded upon probable cause. In the end, the petition made, of course, to a trial jury that there is evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that this conduct has taken place. In this particular case, a split verdict in Tyree Nichols' situation, his death, which we continue to mourn, as does his family, as does the community. Important lessons coming out about civil rights in America, prosecutions, and the role of the Department of Justice now and in the future as well. We know as well that beyond what happened in Memphis this past week, other issues around the country, including right here in Wisconsin, where we have a federal judge in the Western District of our state, telling the Rusk County town of Thornapple to resume using electronic voting machines after the town's board had switched to hand-counting paper ballots in the two elections earlier of this year. Now, what's this case all about? Well, the chief judge, his name is Judge James Peterson. He's in Wisconsin's Western District. This, again, is in a federal district court in the state of Wisconsin, but it's a federal court. States that the town's clerk and the three-member board of supervisors actually violated something called the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, by failing to provide at least one voting system equipped for individuals with disabilities at its single polling place in the April 2nd and August 13th elections, basically finding that this decision to rely just upon hand-counted ballots here was in violation of federal law. That's the finding of Judge James Peterson. According to court documents, the town's former clerk, her name is Suzanne Pinnow, P-I-N-N-O-W, had cited what she described as the controversial nature of electronic voting machines during a June 2023 town board meeting. She was using that to justify the move to hand-counting ballots, the paper ballots there. And the meeting from the minutes from the meeting show that she also claimed that municipalities with less than 7,000 voters are not required to use voting machines. That was the position of the town clerk, rejected plainly by the federal district court just this past week. The injunction basically stems from a joint agreement. This is an agreement between the U.S. Department of Justice, the investigators again in the Civil Rights Division, and Thorn Apple officials, in which the town agreed now to provide one electronic voting machine at the town's sole polling place. And again, according to this agreement, the voting system is for the full period that the polling place is required to be open under Wisconsin state law, plugged into a functioning electrical outlet, turned on and readily visible and accessible to voters. That's the agreement now that comes out of this decision from the judge and comes out of this joint agreement. The town has also agreed not to enforce its June 2023 resolution to stop the use of the electronic voting machine, to post signs alerting voters that the voting machine is available now for use, and to allow representatives of the U.S. Department of Justice to ensure that the court's order is being followed in the upcoming election. That's the November 5th election in just a few days. In a statement, again, here is the Assistant Attorney General responsible for all of these kinds of things. This, of course, a civil matter, unlike the Tyree Nichols matter. But here she is once again commenting upon the important role of the Department of Justice. Her name is Kirsten Clark, K-L-A-A-R-K-E, U.S. Department of Justice Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. She says this. She says that what's happening here is that the injunction, again imposed by Judge Peterson, based upon the agreement of the parties, affirms the rights of voters with disabilities to participate on the same terms as every other voter. That, according to Kristen Clark, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. She goes on to say, the Help America Vote Act protects that right in every town in Wisconsin and every jurisdiction across the country by requiring that every voter has the opportunity to use an accessible voting system. And again, the U.S. Department of Justice has sued the town of Thorn Apple based upon its exclusive use of counting ballots by hand. The Rusk County town of Lawrence on September 20th, alleging that federal law had been broken by not offering at least one accessible electronic voting machine in elections held this year. The town of Lawrence also negotiated an agreement with the DOJ, which was entered into the court record the same day as the government's lawsuit was filed. And that mirrors the injunction imposed by Judge Peterson on Friday. So you've got lots of things going on to remedy this belief that somehow the law is not violated by simply using a process of hand-counting ballots. Thorn Apple officials had pushed back initially on the allegations by the Department of Justice that it broke federal law. Attorneys representing the town initially had said that the lawsuit should be dismissed, and they argued that this Help America Vote Act requires any voting system used after January 6th to include at least one direct electronic voting system, and that the town's hand-counted paper ballots used in April and August didn't constitute a voting system under federal law, parsing out the language of the Help America Vote Act to say that our process doesn't count under the federal law. Interesting, rejected plainly by the federal district court judge here. The judge, again, disregarded that view, denied it, and said that the motion to dismiss would have to not be granted. The two complaints against Thorn Apple are also pending in the Wisconsin Election Commission as the elections go forward. More of all this coming up as we continue here on...
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
I don't know about other states, but in Wisconsin, we help our neighbors and love our communities. But California mega millionaire Eric Hovde doesn't seem to get that. Maybe that's why he questioned whether children should be able to stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26. And whether people in nursing homes should be able to vote. Hovde called for raising the retirement age for hardworking Wisconsinites and making obese people pay more for health care. And a Hovde company even spent decades trying to demolish the building housing Madison's oldest family-owned bar, something they finally did this year, shuttering a treasured neighborhood institution for good. That is not how we do things in Wisconsin. And that is why we can't let California mega millionaire Eric Hovde represent us.
Paid for by a Better Wisconsin Together Action. ABWT-action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
This is the final segment of our weekly weekend broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review, talking about many, many issues, including voting here in the state of Wisconsin, voting around our nation, all of which impacting dramatically the forthcoming November election and having an impact upon things going on here in the state of Wisconsin and in those other states. A part of the discussion out there in America is also the extent to which crime has overtaken our nation. These statements, once again, by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and others in support of them, that somehow America has been overrun by crime and that it's the fault of the present administration and previous administrations, presumably not including Donald Trump's. Well, let's take a look at what the FBI has said about that. Again, a reliable source, a credible source that tracks crime statistics in America across the country using both federal statistics, state statistics, relying necessarily upon reporting by local law enforcement, obliged under the law to provide this information to national authorities, to the FBI, in determining what is the state of crime in America. Are statistics indicating that crime is going up? Is it going down? Is it remaining static? Well, just this past week, once again, the FBI, Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, has announced that indeed the statistics from the FBI show a continued significant drop in U.S. crime in the first 6 months of 2024, indicating that representations to the contrary are simply wrong. They're not founded upon any facts. The actual things that are going on there in our cities, in our towns, and our villages of America. Crime in the United States, according to the FBI's credible and reliable report, dropped throughout the first 6 months of 2024. Again, these are the figures provided by the FBI. That continues what you all know as a continuing trend in the falling crime rates beginning last year and continuing to this date, beginning even before last year over large periods of time. What are the numbers in particular? The new numbers show that murders from January to June, again, of this year, murders, homicides, dropped 23%, 23% compared to the same period just last year. And again, last year, there was also a drop in that figure. Violent crime overall fell 10%, and reported rapes decreased by 18%. Violent crime overall, 10% reduction, rapes reported decreased by 18%. Aggravated assaults during that same period decreased 8% over the past year, according to this same data. Robberies fell 14%, and reported property crimes came down 13%. That is significant. These double digits, these significant changes in the reduction in crime, again, any crime intolerable, any crime necessarily the subject not only of investigation, but of condemnation, obviously, our goal one day, as it has always been in the 240-year history of our nation, to make certain that we are all completely safe and secure. Probably, regrettably, unfortunately, an unrealistic goal. But nonetheless, that is the goal. That is the purpose of law enforcement, to keep us safe and secure and try to reduce to the extent possible, to the absolute minimum, situations where crime happens. And once again, this stunning and significant report coming out of the FBI just this past week that crime statistics show a decrease, not an increase, a significant decrease across the board in everything from murders to violent crime generally to rapes to aggravated assaults, robberies, and property crimes, all of those down by double figures. Now, again, all of this has been the subject of a lot of discussion during the course of the campaign, and it's important for Americans to understand what is in fact the truth and what is in fact not the truth. And so when, for example, the former president says that hundreds of people, as he said recently, have been murdered because of her action at the border, speaking about Kamala Harris, thousands more will follow in rapid succession. She should be impeached, he said, and prosecuted for her actions. Also condemns basically the entire law enforcement initiatives, a set of initiatives by the Department of Justice, saying that, again, the American cities, our villages, our towns, talks a lot about carnage in America. You recall that well during his inaugural address when he first became president in 2017. That attitude, that view, that statement that we continue to be a crime-ridden nation where crime continues to increase and cause these great problems in our cities, simply not supported by the facts presented by the FBI just this past week. He says also, of course, a lot about the statistics themselves. He rejects them, of course, even when the statistics confirm with great reliability just the opposite. Trump wrongly claims that the statistics are specifically about people who are now living freely in the U.S. The figures actually include people who are currently in jails and prisons serving criminal sentences. So again, describing the categories that are captured by these numbers inaccurately and giving false senses of the extent to which crime in America continues to be a part of our regular lives. The preliminary figures by the FBI, part of what's called the Quarterly Uniform Crime Report, covers January through June, comes with an important limitation, and that is that it is information provided by policing agencies voluntarily. There are an awful lot of agencies out there that still don't provide that information. The extent it's not a part of this, it is not represented. But the numbers released on this just this past week are gathered from about 14,800 of the just over 19,000 law enforcement agencies across the country. So a great majority of them provided this information, according to the FBI. And, of course, the FBI continues to monitor this, providing more reports at the end of this calendar year as it goes forward. All of that important once again as the campaign proceeds. And we understand not only what the truth is in all these areas, but also understand what the facts are when it comes to crime in America. Indeed, the FBI confirming for us that in recent months, the first 6 months of this calendar year alone, crime has dropped significantly in our major cities, our major towns, and our villages. Appreciate and value your time with me this weekend on this, our broadcast, where we talk about all things related to judges and courts and the rule of law and the administration of justice. Join me again next week for more of this important discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, Pete Schwabe.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Chicago film critic and historian Maria Gates, and Heather Heil from the Green Bay Children's Museum joins me in studio to discuss upcoming events.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe, weeknights from 6 till 8.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop.
That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and this is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC.